Good afternoon to everyone. The subject is the economics of fractional reserve banking. I actually started working on this in 2009 when I was summer fellow here. And you know that this is a very hot issue. If you touch that, some people lose their nerves and behave like kids. But this is not my problem. So if George Sajan wants to destroy his academic reputation, so be it. Sometimes it's also called the economics of fractional reserve free banking, but this is already a petitio principii, because this is another question: if this would be a violation of property rights, or if it would be allowed in a free society. I mean, it doesn't make sense to speak about the economics of free murder, and so why the economics of free banking? No? Why call it free? So only fractional reserve banking. Let's talk about the economic arguments that David Howden and I have given and George Sajan's response. You have had the readings. So the first and maybe the most innovative argument by Sajan is that fractional reserve banking has mechanisms to lead to a monetary equilibrium and restricts as a necessarily also coordinated credit expansion. How is monetary equilibrium defined? Well, there's neither an excess supply nor an excess demand at a given price level. So Sajan asserts that the fractional reserve banking system adjusts the money supply to changes in the demand for money. So MV in the equation of exchange gets stabilized. If V goes down, if the demand for money goes up, automatically the free banks, fractional reserve banks, increase the money supply.
Can you put that diagram, just put the equation on the board, Philip, just a little further.
So MVPT, so he says, if this goes down, this goes up. So if V goes down, the demand for money goes up. So they produce more money. Why? Because when the demand for money increases, there's less gross clearings at the banks. So they have depositors write fewer checks or redeem fewer banknotes. And this means that banks have to hold less precautionary reserves, which means that they have excess reserves and they can expand credit, increasing the money supply in response to the increase in the demand for money. And he says that this is a better way to establish equilibrium than, for example, the central bank increasing the money supply in response to increasing the demand for money. And it's also better than having prices adjust downwards in response to an increase in the demand for money due to price stickiness and other causes. And then he makes also the point that there's inherently a limit to coordinated credit expansion in a fractional reserve banking system. Because the question is, if banks, fractional reserve banks, expand at the same rhythm their credits, they don't lose reserve against each other because they expand at the same rhythm. And he also makes a claim that in a major fractional reserve banking system, there will be no demand for money proper. So the public will not go to banks and redeem their notes against gold, for example. So how would then the coordinated credit expansion be limited? There would be no loss of reserves against gold reserves against other banks, nor against the general public, because the general public just uses the banknotes and doesn't use gold. So here he comes up with this innovative idea. He says that the demand for bank reserves consists of two components. One is the average net reserve demand. That is the anticipated difference of clearing debits and clearing credits in a period. So if I expand more my credits than another bank, I demand as a bank a net reserve demand. Of course, this is zero. The net reserve demand is zero if it's a coordinated credit expansion, because banks don't lose reserves against other banks. But there's a second component, and this is the precautionary reserve demand. What is this? Well, he says, when there's credit expansion, there's a growth in total clearings that will bring about a higher variance of clearing balances. So if there is coordinated credit expansion, the net reserve demand nets out to zero because they don't lose reserves to others, but banks increase their precautionary reserve demands because the gross clearings in a given period are increasing. So they need more precautionary reserves. And this is the limit for him on a coordinated credit expansion. So our question was then, can precautionary reserves really limit a coordinated credit expansion? Well, we argue not necessarily if banks really coordinate and work together. The first mechanism to remove this limit would be that banks with a positive clearing balance just voluntarily refrain from redeeming their notes from other banks. They could just use these notes as reserves for their own credit expansion. And as they know that this will cancel out in the long term, why redeem the notes? And if you want to coordinate and cooperate, why do that? Why not cooperate closely in the sense that you don't redeem the notes? Second, an interbank market could develop. So then banks with a negative clearing balance, that they are gross clearings, and in one period I have negative gross clearings. So I just go to the interbank market and borrow from banks with a positive clearing balance. And the interest paid on these loans, interbank loans, cancel out in the long run because we have a coordinated credit expansion. So you can have the implicit or explicit arrangement concerning the short-term interbank financing of these clearing deficits. The third mechanism to remove this limit would be to simply lengthen the clearing period. So if you have a very short clearing period of 1 hour or 1 day, okay, then you can have important clearing balances divergence, even within a coordinated expansion. But the longer you go with your clearing period, the lower are the gross clearing differences. So conforming you are expanding credit, you can ever more lengthen the clearing period and the gross clearings are ever less. And of course, if you make an unlimited clearing period, then there's no limit. No bank will lose any reserves. And the final reason why banks actually may reduce their precautionary reserves during a credit expansion is that a credit expansion means that asset prices tend to rise because there's an increase in the money supply. Interest rate tends to fall. There's more liquidity in the market. That is the negotiability or the negotiability of bank assets increase. That is, there may not be really a higher danger of illiquidity for banks, because in the credit expansion at the same time the prices of the assets that they have increase and the liquidity increases, so they can more easily sell these assets if they have a negative clearing balance. So the banks can use these more valuable and saleable assets to compensate for any adverse clearing balances. So what was Sajjan's response to this? Well, in general, besides the insults that he put in, and the his suggestion that we misread him and misunderstood him, or that we had no idea on monetary theory, his response is quite actually evasive and without much substance. So he defends fractional reserve of banking by stating that a true coordination in a credit expansion, although possible, so he admits it, but it would not be very likely. So this is his defense. So, well, it's possible, but not very likely. However, if we assume that banks want to maximize profits, and when we acknowledge that credit expansion is a very lucrative business, it is difficult to see why it would not be in the best interest of banks to expand credit through cooperation. Of course, this cooperation is inherently unstable, but this is another question. And this actually explains the pressure to install central banks. And let's go to the questions afterwards. And this explains the pressure to install a central bank, this instability actually. So there are strong incentives to install central banks because of this. Then the second point or critique that we do is that we argue that the demand for fiduciary media, the demand for bank liabilities, is not exogenous to the banking system. So first of all, Sajjan starts his analysis without distinguishing between the demand for commodity money and the demand for money substitutes. Well, he just assumes that all commodity money is deposited in the banks and remains there, and the demand for money proper is constant. So he just deals with the demand for money substitutes. However, this is problematic because the demand for money proper and the demand for money substitutes does not have to go in the same direction. Actually, during economic crisis, they go in opposite directions. You know, during a bank run, people sell bank liabilities or redeem their deposits and demand money proper. And it's our argument that fractional reserve banking actually causes booms that then turn into bust because of the inherently instability of this procedure. And in this recession, then the bank's assets lose in value. They are bad loans, they are malinvestments. And at this point, the confidence of the holders of bank liabilities, of money substitutes, evaporates, and then the demand for money proper increases. So we argue actually that the fractional reserve banking system is the cause of the instability in the demand for money proper. So we argue to assume a constant demand for money proper, or saying that there's only demand for money substitutes, that cannot be a starting point to analyze the system. Because Sajjan assumes that in the beginning that the demand for money proper is constant, in order to show that the system is unstable. But if the system is unstable, the demand for money proper is unstable also. And then we go on and argue that the fractional reserve banking system itself may cause an increase in the demand for money. So the fractional reserve banking school repeats the error of the old banking school when they treat the demand for money as exogenous to the banking system. The banking school theorists argue that the needs for trade determine the demand for money. And expanding credit in its response to a higher demand for money would not only cause no harm, but it would even aid economic expansion. So the common error of the banking school and fractional reserve school is that they neglect the fact that the banks can endogenously increase the demand for credit by reducing interest rates. So the demand for future goods, the demand for loans, is not independent of its price, of the interest rate. So by lowering interest rates and softening credit conditions, a fractional reserve banking system can increase the demand for credits virtually without limit. What is Sajjan's response to that? Well, he evades somehow the question by stating that in his model, endogenous credit expansion by lowering interest rates is impossible because banks cannot lower interest rates because they have already reached the limit for their credit expansion as determined by precautionary reserves. That was the first argument. So a bank is consequently unable to increase the money supply without a prior increase in the demand for money. Of course, this goes then back to the initial question as how controlling precautionary reserves actually are for limiting credit expansion. And another question would be how would the process be to reach this limit? The next point is on the confusion between savings and the demand for cash holdings. And Sajjan states explicitly that the willingness to hold money substitutes is the willingness to save, and that holding bank liabilities ultimately means lending. So I think this is really the most fundamental error and the crucial point in this debate. Because real saving implies an abstention from consumption, while the production of fiduciary media does not. Fiduciary media may be created ex nihilo. So holding newly created money does not imply an increase in real saving, because otherwise you would confuse increases in the nominal money supply with an increase in real resources. Like if we...
Hold the question till the end.
I just said it before. Yeah. Because it may be that I later, just in a minute, address what you wanted to say. So if the U.S. government just adds a zero to every banknote and bank deposits, then the willingness to hold bank deposits nominally increases 10 times, but there's no increase in real savings. And then creating new money to offset this increase in demand to hold money does not create any new real reserves. And then Sajjan says, okay, but this is true, this is obvious, I never said that. He says then, well, I'm not talking about increases in the nominal demand for money, but I'm only talking about the increases in the real demand for money. However, what he neglects is that banks react to increases in the nominal demand for money or in the nominal demand to hold bank liabilities. So imagine that there's like a counterfeiter that counterfeits $1,000 and he deposits it in his bank. So the demand to hold bank liabilities had increased. Okay, we can say that's a nominal demand to hold bank liabilities. However, there are more reserves for the fractional reserve bank, and it will expand credit, grant new loans to business, and there will be new investment projects financed, even though there's no increase in real resources at all. So it's hard to see for me why Sajjan doesn't see this point. Then what is also important is that the time horizon in which people are willing to sacrifice themselves and reduce consumption is very important for the investment sustainability. So not all savings are the same. So holding cash is not the same as holding equity, or a 3-month loan is not the same as holding a 30-year bond. They don't allow for the same amount of sustainable investments. So what is also important is the maturities of the savings. And this is what differentiates the monetary savings from each other. Horwitz, for example, also abstracts from the duration of savings by stating that demanding bank liabilities is an act of savings. So for him, basically, holding a bank deposit of $1,000 is the same as an investment in a 30-year bond of $1,000. For him, it releases identical savings to be invested in long-term projects. when then our question is, can a long-term investment, a 30-year mortgage, for example, be issued against either of these two kind of savings with the same effects of the structure of production? We say no. Also, changes in time preference rates are actually independent of the demand to hold money as a cash balance. So I can increase my cash balance without saving more. For example, I can abstain from reinvesting my resources, just amortizing investments. So then a relative shift away from investment project has happened, from future goods, and time preference has actually increased. And cash holdings increase at the time, same time. However, free bankers then, fractional reserve bankers interpret this then as an increase to hold, in the demand to hold bank liabilities, which would constitute an increase in savings. So, for example, if I own a factory, for example, and I say, well, I want to increase my cash balance, I stop maintenance costs of the factory, I increase my cash balance. Am I saving? No, but the bank has a higher more reserves and can expand credits. Am I offering more present goods to be invested? No. So following the logic of fractional reserve bankers, they must actually maintain that a divestment of capital, so the veering down of machinery and factories in order to increase cash balance, is a sign of increased demand for money and represents an increase in savings. So banks could and should expand credit when their reserves increase, so that investors can commence new investment project. So building new factories and so on, even though people wanted to decrease their investment. So this fractional reserve banking credit expansion does not correspond with the desires of the economic agents. So the real cash balance have increased, for example, in response to higher uncertainty or in preparation for future consumption opportunities. So people have divested. So they have increased the proportion of their consumption relative to the investment spending. So actually the time preference has increased. And then carrying out a credit expansion to start new investment projects obviously leads to malinvestments, because the real quantity of savings available to sustain this investment projects has not increased. So there is no necessary relation between time preference rate or real savings and the demand for money. Furthermore, neither changes in the demand or the supply of money are necessarily related to the interest rate. They can, of course, affect the interest rate in the short term if they go through the credit market. No? If the supply of money is increased through the credit market, for example. This confusion between increases in savings and cash holdings is actually a confusion between stock and flow variables. So saving is the flow variable. It's the part of the income that is not consumed. While the cash holdings, or savings with an S, savings, represent a stock in existence. So cash holdings do not represent saving. So one may actually increase his cash holdings by saving less and consuming more. For example, by spending a smaller part of the income on investment purposes. So what fractional reserve banking actually leads to is a change in the stock variable, the cash holdings, the savings, that may create the artificial illusion of a change in the flow variable, in the saving. And this misperception is then not without negative consequences as entrepreneurs may be misled into committing malinvestments. Well, another question about this holding bank liabilities amounting to saving would be, why would not holding money proper be equally saving? So let's assume that I have my money at home, my savings at home. I safe keep it at home, but then I see in the newspaper that there was a robbery recently in my neighborhood, so I decide to put it in my bank. I think it's safer there. So following Federal Reserve Bankers' reasoning, the bank reserves have increased and the willingness to hold bank liabilities has increased also. Then banks can and should expand credits in response. And interest rates will fall as a consequence. So the question is, were interest rates artificially high before that when I had the savings at home? Is there any increase in real savings and real resources available just by the fact that I put my money that I had at home under my mattress into the bank? They have just changed location. So if then there's an expansion of credits, this leads to artificially low interest rates. Federal Reserve bankers had to argue that hoarding, unaccompanied by credit expansion, leads to artificially high interest rates. So if I put the money below my mattress, if I'm hoarding, then the interest rates are artificially high. I better put it in the bank. However, when I hoard money and this money stems from consumption spending, this causes actually the interest rate to decline. Also when I hoard the money at home, because prices of consumption goods fall relatively to prices of higher order goods. So the price spread in the time structure of production between the buying and selling prices is reduced accordingly. So the demand for present goods actually then falls relatively to the demand of future goods, causing the interest rate to fall. So even if I abstain from consumption and hoard it at home, the interest rate will fall and there will be more real resources to be invested. Federal Reserve banks face an identification problem, in the sense that they don't know why do our reserves increase. Did people abstain from consumption spending or from investment spending? How would it be coordinating for Federal Reserve banks to induce investments when people actually want to divest? Right? They reduce their investment spending to increase their cash balance. So what is Sagan's response? As his weakest point, he basically repeats that to hold inside money is to engage in voluntary saving. Well, this implies that to hold more inside money is to engage more voluntary saving. And then he says, well, I actually do not say that overall saving increases. It may well be that the saving in the form of inside money of bank liabilities increases and the saving in form of other financial assets decreases. So, for example, I sell a bond and put the money in my bank account. So, and then he says the total amount of savings has not changed at all. So suppose that I had bought a 10-year bond and it matures, I get the money back, and then I put it in the bank account. And then there's an increase in the demand for bank liabilities, no increase in the amount of savings, so total savings are constant. So he says then the bank has to lend out the deposited money. So, why is this analysis of him unsatisfactory, or his response? Well, for several reasons. First, he conveniently ignored our argument concerning the location of savings, like when I take my money under my mattress and put it in the bank. And this results in credit expansion. It remains unclear in this case how the savings rate has changed, and then banks expand credit on top of the fresh deposit. While real savings necessary to sustain investments have not changed at all. And this example is only a change in the location and not a shift from a financial asset or a bond into a demand for a bank liability. And we have to take into account here the bank multiplier, no? That depends on the reserve ratio. That when I have the money at my home and I deposit it in the bank will not only lend the deposited amount, but through the bank multiplier, the reserves will go to other banks, and so it will be actually be more than that. So even if I sell the 10-year bond and then I deposit the money in the bank, there will be more lent than actually the money I got back from the bond. Of course, the opposite is also possible. So if someone withdraws his savings from his banks to hold it at home, then bank lending must contract by a multiple of that amount. And a fractional reserve banker may actually consider this reduction of lending as bad. And Sajjan actually admits that. He says, quote, holding money proper, that I get money out of the bank to my home, only leads to prohibitively high interest rates when it involves cashing in bank IOUs, which of course means that lending, though not saving, declines. So he thinks this is an economic problem if people get the money out of the bank and put it under the mattress because bank lending contracts. Second, with his counter-argument that overall savings do not change if I sell the bond and put it in the bank, well, not all savings are the same. Holding a bond is not the same as holding equity, a time deposit, or a demand deposit. Only if you do a too high aggregation, you can treat saving as a homogeneous fund that just changes the means through which it materializes. So think about this example. Isn't there a significant difference between someone purchasing a 10-year bond for $1,000 and depositing money in a bank account of $1,000? If I invest in the bond for 10 years, I release the use of our resources for 10 years, while in the second case, in a fractional reserve banking system, there may be an expansion of credit actually in excess of the original deposit. So there is a difference, in our opinion, in these two kinds of examples, like buying a bond or depositing the money, and that is the time dimension of the savings. The time that the lender pledges to abstain from consumption, which is very important for the sustainability of investment projects. So if people save for 10 years and then want to increase consumption thereafter, then investment projects that take 10 years are sustainable. So, and then Sajjan repeats, well, we actually have said this all the time, say you better have read our paper 1996, Session and White. There we say that holding money is one form of saving does not imply that an increase in the demand for money is identical to an increase in total saving. No. But again, so from his point of view, that is when a person saves via a 10-year bond and then gets the money back and puts it in a bank account or a bank or in a bond of 3-year maturity, nothing had changed. Total saving is the same. But perhaps the bond matrix and I put the money in my bank account or I put it in a time deposit of 3 months because in 3 months I need the money to go on a vacation or I want to buy a television set. So at some point in the future I want to increase my expenditures and increase consumption. So the demand for consumer goods will rise before the investment project is completed. So if I invest in the 10-year bond, so I abstain from consumption 10 years, I wait 10 years for new television sets. So the money is given to companies and they make a more efficient production of television sets and then in 10 years' time, I increase my consumption, there are more televisions. Okay, now I change the example. I put the same money in my bank account and the fractional reserve banks also gives more loans to companies that then engage in very long-term processes that in 10-year times produce more television sets. But maybe in 3 months then, I want to increase my consumption, but the additional television sets are not ready yet. They are just in the mine, digging out the new commodities to increase production, consumer goods production in 10-year time. So there's a discoordination between saving and investment. So while Sajjan is correct that the fractional reserve banking system can detect when an individual has increased his demand for bank liabilities, the system cannot know when that individual will spend his higher cash balance. So, and then what he also ignores is that an increase in real cash holdings can be via divestment of real capital projects. And this he ignores. You can increase your cash balance not only by divesting from financial assets, by selling a bond, but also from divestment in physical capital. So the example that we have is that, like, I have a factory with 10 machines, or let's say with... if you have 10 machines and I get an income every year of $100, $50 I spend on consumption, and let's assume that every year one machine is destroyed, of course it wears down, so for $50 I rebuy the machine every year, the machine that breaks down. So let's assume now that uncertainty increases and then the individual wants to increase his cash balance. So let's say, okay, this year from this 100, I won't spend everything. I will buy a smaller machine. I will invest less. Okay, I increase my cash balance $30. So then... consumption spending obviously increases relatively to real saving. So for me, it's obvious that the real saving has increased. Consumer goods prices will rise relatively to prices of machines or products of higher stages of production. And fewer goods will be available to sustain the existing investment projects. So actually here, the time preference of the individual has increased. And the structure of production will become less capital intensive. What is the reaction again of a fractional reserve banking system? well, if I put the 30 bucks in my bank, then the bank will have excess reserves. And the bank can give an additional loans to companies. So and additional investments projects will be financed. But real savings actually has decreased. So the result is a distortion of the structure of production. So the problem here is that in contrast to Selgin, we regard saving not merely holding money, but at that portion of income that is unconsumed. So a certain number of goods is produced in every period, and the portion of real goods that is not consumed that we regard as real savings, and these real savings can then be used to sustain investment projects. So we have to distinguish between saving, the portion of unconsumed real income, and the stock of monetary savings. And there's no necessary correlation between the portion of unconsumed real income of the individual and his cash balance. So how much time do we have? Or shall I end?
We leave a half hour for questions.
Yeah, so
that's about 6 minutes fast. Stop.
Okay, stop.
Yeah, this is a tough question.
So, your questions?
Hard to know where to begin.
The point you were focusing on with the divestment from investment, not freeing up real resources for uses, there's a machine that they could have bought after it's depreciated that they choose not to buy. Is that not a real resource that they let up in not buying it? That the bank would lend the money out and to another company who would buy the machine?
I don't understand the point. So he's buying a smaller machine,
yeah,
that is less productive.
The real resources that he has let up are the things that he did not buy that he was going originally to buy.
He's consuming more.
No, I understand the exact.
So the consumer goods prices will rise relatively to the prices of machines.
If the bank doesn't lend the money out to another company that buys the machine that he didn't buy.
Right.
So there's no problem.
Well, I would argue that, yes, there's a problem.
Well,
because time preference rate has increased.
No, not necessarily.
Well, the relation between his consumer,
not through a real cash balance effect, then there's no reason to assume that time preference has changed.
Wait, can you clarify the example for a second? I was a little confused about it. He earns gross revenues of $100 a year.
Yeah.
Okay, and so then 50 is for depreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And 50 is for consumption. Why is there any change in time preference there?
Well, we assume that there's a change in... Well, no, at this point, not.
For him, no, there's no change. Okay.
But then something happens, whatever happens, and he wants to increase his cash balance.
Oh, from that point onward, I see.
So uncertainty increases or whatever.
Okay, I wasn't clear on that.
And then, he could reduce consumption and investment spending in the same proportion, but he decides to increase his investment spending. And I interpret this as an increase in his time preference.
If
but
you're
you don't.
That money is a present good, and that money should interfere with the proportion of consumption to investment when there's a change in the demand for cash balances.
Well, I see there's not only the change in the demand for cash balance, but at the same time a change in the time preference, right?
Unless he's spending more money on consumption, why should consumption increase? He's exhibited no demand for an increase in consumption.
He's consuming capital.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to assume that money is a present good or a future good. It's simply a medium of exchange, so he allocates on three margins.
Yeah, but the which one is preferable to happen when he increases his cash balance in this sense depends on whether it's a present or a future good. Because if you consider it as a future good, then time preference itself hasn't changed. Because the proportion of the real assets that are being...
Well, you're defining the problem away. I see. You're defining the problem away. The point is that money is a medium of exchange. Unless it's, unless there is a change in the proportions spent on something, then it's prices that are affecting everything. The prices of, relative price, consumer investment goods.
Well, one question. Let's change it to this. He reduces it to 30. So the alternative would be to reduce it here to 40 and here to 40. So you are saying it's irrelevant?
Not
the two are the irrelevant?
No, it's not irrelevant. That's
it's
not
irrelevant for the... So, so it's the same.
He chooses not to reinvest in the machine that is broken. Whether he chooses not to buy it at all or whether he chooses to buy a smaller machine, it doesn't matter. He's just choosing not to invest the same amount that he was going to invest. That there's no problem of real resources being let up, because the real resource that he has let up is the machine that he hasn't bought. He hasn't gone out and increased spending on consumption.
So it would have
no problem of real resources that the Austrian business cycle theory would talk about.
No, there's no, because an increase in time preference rate doesn't mean a business cycle.
It's not important if he doesn't increase his spending on consumption. If he increases spending on consumption instead of increasing his cash balance, if he's on this one margin, just between consumption and investment, then yes, there's a problem of real resources. There need to be real resources for him to be able to consume that he has let up in a different form in terms of not buying the machine. So there needs to be an adjustment in the processes of production.
The price of machines fall then?
Which is the causal mechanism for why there's a shift in the proportion of consumption to investment.
So the full price of consumer's goods. And the resource up.
But no, there's no fall in the price of consumers' goods.
No.
When he does
investment goods.
The machine.
Investment goods.
Okay.
Full price of investment goods. So they pay lower wages in those industries. And consumption spending hasn't changed, as you admit, and he says. And therefore, relative prices of consumer
they
goods.
They shift. But this is.
And you have to shift.
Argue with this at all.
Oh, okay.
You should, maybe.
This mechanism would not. It would be a working mechanism and that the price would fall if nothing else happened. What he's saying is that his system would work better because another company would get the money and buy the machine.
Oh,
it's just shifting from one form of investment to another.
You're not allowing that person to change the time preference to affect the time.
If they're increasing their consumption, the whole economy shouldn't be producing more consumption goods because he is simply not invested in something.
Yeah. So that's all.
Well, this
on that.
Defeats your whole argument.
No.
Yes, it does. You focus
I don't
on
see.
Half of the time.
I don't see why.
$20 will be spent only on investment goods and not both on investment consumption goods.
I mean, how do I know?
The bank could win without
stipulating this in the example.
Yeah, well, your next question was, let's go to someone else before we go back to you.
And then if you could have another question. Yeah.
Well, okay.
No, I didn't really have a question. I guess what Eric was trying to say that saving is defined in the sense of not spending on consumer goods. So I guess that's sort of the point he's trying to make, where if you decrease investment spending and you build up your cash balance, it's still saving. Like that's just his point. I don't have another question.
I have a quick question. You pointed out that business cycles will cause the demand for inside money. The demand for the money proper, let's say, to increase and cause the banking system to become unstable. But it's not just business cycles. You can concede Zelda's point on that if you wanted to. Though you're obviously correct on that. But what about the failure of large firms? Just in the course of entrepreneurial activity, some large firms fail and they default at big banks, let's say, and then it doesn't have to be a business cycle, right? To bring forth this increase in demand for money proper.
Right.
So you're actually conceding a little bit too much to him, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Because he would say, well, otherwise the business cycle doesn't occur.
Right.
Yeah. And Anna Schwartz, when she responded to him at a conference about that, said something like, Well, it's also true if you have a balance of payments deficit. Now, she wasn't thinking in terms of the closed economy. She said people are going to want the money proper, or she called them the base money. Same thing, right? You have to pull it out and pay. But I guess he would come back and say, well, it's a closed economy.
Another point, I want to know why you think that the mechanism he has described in terms of higher variance clearing balances wouldn't be effective in reality. You've, of course, described some reasons why it conceivably might not be, but the important question is whether or not, in reality, it would be effective or not. The question is whether or not the impact on their expected profits over a long term will be negatively or positively affected by the actions that they're choosing to make in terms of their reserve ratio.
Well,
so please describe the reason why it will adjust appropriately and in line with the system he's talked and changes in the demand for money. And you've described reasons why it might not be. But it's sort of, to the extent that it's an empirical question, you can, of course, conceive of ways in which it would work either way.
Well, I thought this argument originally was not empirical, but theoretical, that it would effectively limit. So if he now concedes it's just an empirical question, I think we have already gone one step farther in the debate, which is actually good.
I don't really care that much about what he has argued. But the fact is that it is an empirical question, and if you want to argue the point, I feel like you haven't, I don't think you have cited any sort of evidence that would be somewhat empirically contingent at all as to why this wouldn't be an effective mechanism.
What do you mean? Like, well, we argue that there's an inherent tendency of these banks to cooperate and enforce this cooperation through a central bank and the Fed.
Perhaps the Fed
would be one historical example, for example.
I don't think the Fed emerged in the sort of climate that he's describing. It occurred for political reasons.
Well, I think banks pushed for the establishing of the central of the Fed.
But in this type of system he's describing,
Well, then we don't have, as this type of system never existed. We can't have any empirical evidence on that.
Well, he's also cited examples where he thinks the system existed.
Well, maybe.
You mean maybe.
He thinks that's an example. But it's been rebutted,
meaning that people adduced evidence. Seacrest, Rockport.
I would even go to Seacrest because he's a free banker and he smashes white on that.
So there's empirical evidence against the one example that Selden adduces. So I think that's sufficient, right? It's not that
just showing that it's not exactly what he was talking about isn't sufficient to show that the point being made.
You talk about empirical, and that's the only empirical example he cites. So if he doesn't have any empirical example,
Empirical evidence is just being if there's a system exactly how he has described it out there in the world, then that's the only way to get empirical evidence about how that system would work. Only if it's exactly the same.
But I thought you said that he wasn't making an empirical argument. His claim was empirical, but he wasn't supporting with empirical evidence. And then Selden's also making an empirical claim.
Well, there's some papers he cited on this principle that he's talked about just from general research in banking.
Are they theoretical papers?
I go back and find the paper.
I mean, somebody's theory of how banking works. And he's got another theory.
Yeah, but the theory comes from...
It always depends on your theory how you interpret the history. So there are people who interpret the Scottish experience very differently than Sagan does. So you should first get your theory right. And then if you have to admit that it is in principle possible to have a coordinated...
You can have different theories describing different things and you want to know which one applies. You can't know... The idea that the history is just irrelevant unless you have a theory is wrong. You can have many theories which describe history well.
No, I just say you need the theory to interpret, understand history. I'm not saying history is irrelevant. It's two different things.
You said to get the theory right, but you can have a variety of theories that are all logically possible. and justifiable at a pure abstract level, but whether or not they apply to the case at hand is not merely up to you as a theorist. It also requires an engagement with actual empirical evidence.
Which takes
it's not as if you pick
stronger
you get the theory right here,
reality,
and then you just...
whether it's adverse variance and clearing balances or the all of the incentives they might have to collude. That's either theory can describe a situation where they have assumed either tendency being stronger. Each one is, neither one can be said to be right or wrong on the basis of theory alone. It's an empirical question, and you can't answer that with theory.
Yeah,
you can just take the theory, apply it to the history, and know which theory was right like that.
Yeah.
If certain assumptions are there in the data, then you can, look, if you don't have money and you're saying it's, you have the ocean through the business cycle and it applies, no, it doesn't apply. So it's basic things in the data that you're right. I mean, but I don't think it's, you have all these theories and they're all logical and you know, people eat more peanut butter on there.
But knowing which one applies is
yeah.
which one is relevant.
There's some just some assumptions that are made. You have to find that they are empirically accurate. I agree.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just one remark. When you're debating on method, history proves nothing. It only illustrates. And I follow up when you said that you have to get the theory right first, and the validation of theory depends on the logical connection to a valid axiom, and not of inducing many facts. You can toss a coin 100 times, and it will 100 times be on the one side, and conclude from that your theory is right. I think it's the other way around. So even if Selgin comes up with an empirical example, the validation of the data he finds presupposes his theory.
Do you think this theory that the stronger tendency for bank managers when deciding on the reserve ratios would be the incentive to conclude can be proved on the basis of an axiom?
You can derive time preference and uncertainty.
I asked a specific question.
Well, I'm answering here specifically.
You can have tendency, right? I mean, part, how we have here.
The tendency is contingent on the actual incentives, which is contingent on the psychological factors, which have the system of praxeology says nothing about.
But whatever the given circumstances, the laws are universal. And,
but the tendencies can be overwhelmed by other tendencies. So which one is
going on? One at a time. And then let the speech.
So what I also wanted to say is that, in theory, at least, it seems that he must admit that this coordination there is no theoretical a priori apodictic limit for a coordinated credit expansion. So a fractional reserve banking system can lead to credit expansion into a business cycle. It can also lead to credit expansion through an increase in base money production. So if the gold is mined, it's put into a bank. Then there's credit expansion, even though there's no necessary increase in real savings, or if it just changes the location from under my mattress into the bank. And finally, if there's an increase in the demand for fiduciary media, this also enables the credit expansion, and Fractional Reserve Bank has actually admitted. And an increase in the demand for fiduciary media, as I said, can come from a divestment. So for these reasons, there can be a credit expansion that then leads to a business cycle, and then in the recession, there's always the demand of depositors to help the poor banks, and of the banks, of course, also to be bailed out. So it's a tendency to install a lender of last resort central bank. So actually, the discussion should be between 100% reserve banking and central banking, because fractional reserve banking tends to convert into this.
What justification is there for the tendency?
We spent half a discussion period on this. Let's see if there's other questions, we can come back to that. Any other questions? Comments?
Yeah, I guess you mostly address the tendency for interbank clearing to limit credit expansion. But what about the tendency for people just demanding outside money or money proper because banks are expanding on top of their deposits? Because they don't, the purchasing power of the fiduciary media is going down. So couldn't there be that possibility to limit
Yeah, his agent rules it out by assumption in the beginning that he says, well, in a major fraction reserve banking system, all money proper is in the banks, and the public will only lose bank liabilities. So this cannot be basically, and as it's so stable the system, there will not be demand for money proper. While we think the opposite is true, the system is unstable and leads in a recession to the increased demand for money proper.
So that would maybe limit the bank's abilities to collude and expand, do you think? Or?
Yeah, and they want to get around it by getting a lender of last resort.
Okay. Do you have any idea why Selgin give any justification for why people would just use banknotes instead of money proper? Is it like technical consideration?
Well, he thinks that money is so stable, so there's so much confidence in the system that there's no need for people actually to do the heavy burn and go with the banknote to get their gold. So why doing this if this is the system just adjusts so well to all changes in the demand for money.
There's interest. It's probably more important than the cost of just carrying around gold money.
I guess maybe one interesting historical thing to look at would be, I guess you're talking about this free banking thing, but I guess to look at countries with relative free banking and see if, whether, like, how much nominal GDP increased, I guess. Seems like that would... taking a somewhat, like, non... Because I guess the idea is that nominal spending would remain constant in an area of perfect free banking. I mean, so it seems, I guess, one way to look at... whether or not a system, I guess, had like a large free banking or not would depend on that. I don't know. I'm curious to see if whether or not, because I guess the problem is nominal GDP is sketchy to find, especially for Scotland, like 1700s, 1800s, or Sweden or Canada. I don't know. I think that something I'd be interested in. I guess because it seems a lot, so whether, because we're talking about whether or not something's free banking or not, like a country, and that could seem to be, like, aside from government, whether how much government or whatever was involved in that, like an interesting sort of empirical test. Do you think that would be somewhat of a possible research, like that'd be somewhat of a quote correct or somewhat illuminating approach to look at, like.
The problem there are so many overlapping factors involved, yeah. And then the data is so imprecise, and then you have the problem that probably everything that is according to the theory, Sajjan will say, okay, it's not a free banking system, and then everything that has the right results, then it is it's a perfect system. So it doesn't prove really.
Anything. I'm just thinking because, like, in terms of long term, maybe the GDP would be like somewhat. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not perfect. Something to look at.
And for these times, there's no GDP data.
Yeah, yeah. No problem.
Mm-hmm. Phil, I have a question about not directly on holding cash balances, but something you mentioned tangentially, and that is that, you know, the difference in savings on the micro level, if it's saving, it's in equity, bonds, long-term bonds, short-term bonds. But I'm not so sure about that, but maybe you can enlighten me. Let's say somebody buys a one-year bond, someone sells a one-year bond, because even though he has a 10-year project in mind, because he's speculating on the interest rate, he wants the interest rate. You believe interest rates are going to fall over time, you have to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe after the fifth year, he's going to lock in with a five-year bond. And then somebody else buys a 10-year bond. I don't think they're doing it because they have different necessarily doing it,
mm-hmm.
necessarily doing it, because they have different lengths of production process in mind. I don't think that follows. And equity, someone might believe that the profits are going to be extremely high and would rather, well, I'm thinking of the equity person who invests in equity, that they want to participate in those high profits. It's enough that it offsets, you know, their risk aversion. Okay, they could lock in. I mean, they could buy a bond and you know, their first claimants and have less risk. So this, I think Murray's kind of right on this. You can move between these different investments. Oh, on both sides, right? I mean, someone who buys, so the other side, someone who buys a 10-year bond may think that interest rates are going to change, and he wants to get out after a year, but he's also, he thinks that interest rates are going to rise, so that the price of the bond is, interest rates are going to fall, but the price of the bond is going to rise, okay? So, you know, he wants to get out after a year. That's his full intention. So I don't think the saver and the investor's intentions have to mesh at all.
I totally agree. Ex ante does not have to be coordinated.
Okay.
But ex post it can be exactly this case that, like, people want to increase consumption in a year.
Yes.
They save for a year,
yeah.
And this is invested in 10-year projects, and they are not finished in a year. So when they want to increase their consumption spending in a year, then there's a distortion of the structure of production.
No, because that one person doesn't matter. In other words, everything.
No, I say all persons.
Oh, you said all persons. Well, that's a different story. I agree. I mean, that can happen. I mean, but that's one assumption, right?
But then that's also the real error.
Well, let me finish. The other assumption is, you know, you can assume that. I think the way to look at it is through monetary calculation. The guy's issuing the bonds for 10 years or 1 year is looking at the interest rates. Which means that if the one person who bought the bond is going to increase consumption after a year rather than wait for 10 years. It doesn't matter because there's other people that are going to take it. But
good.
Do you agree with all that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, then I don't have any.
Yeah.
I just was unclear about it. But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with all. I mean, it's perfectly possible and legitimate to do that, no? To speculate on the interest rate.
You don't think the block.
No, not at all.
Somehow, any sort of maturity is devious and no.
No.
So if it's too much, though, the market will correct it, right?
Yeah. The
okay.
The problem is of course can occur. The problem can occur when there's intervention.
Absolutely, but then the firms that have done that mismatching go out of business.
Right.
And you don't have a collapse of the money supply or anything like that, right? I mean, if you have a sound money.
Yeah.
Ed, you made a point about counterfeiting, and if someone just made money and then put it in the bank, that would distort the level of savings and investment income without pressure on their banking system.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't that happen in a 100% reserve bank? They just print $100 or $1,000 and invest it in some project.
Print dollars, like counterfeiting.
Yeah, if I print $100 billion and invest it all,
that's why it should be forbidden. That's why it should be forbidden, persecuted.
No, I'm asking why it's a. You talked about it like it was a problem particular to this fractional reserve free banking system. I'm asking why would it not apply to any other system?
The point is that it would apply to both systems.
Yeah, so why is it?
He wasn't saying it's something that's likely to happen. He's saying that it's the same as if that was happening. Right? I mean, am I interpreting you correctly?
That the system is.
Yeah. I'm saying there's no real savings, so there's no matter to. You cannot find sustainable new investment projects with it.
Okay, so
even though the demand for bank liabilities has increased.
Okay,
right.
So you're putting it out as an example of essentially how the banking system could counterfeit money?
No, it's an example of increased demand for monetary substitutes or bank liabilities, which a fractional reserve banking system responds to with an increase in the supply of money.
Do you think anyone would disagree with that?
What do you mean? Well, it's reductio ad absurdum. It would be great if you would agree with that.
He says it's all the same. It's as if they're counterfeiting. Not moral, not ethically, but economic.
As in the distortion between
essentially counterfeiting,
or
economic. It's changing.
Whether it's a criminal or a bank, in fact, it's the same. If you print without counterfeiting,
that's what he's saying.
Okay, so you're just saying that the system could work like that.
Well, the only thing that I'm saying is that if you think that an increase in the nominal demand for bank liabilities is an increase in real saving, you are wrong.
What they say.
It's implicitly there because they say
you attributed it to them, and they have defended themselves. And
let me
even pointed out how you wrote through the entire paragraph of Horowitz's book. To misinterpret the last sentence on this point.
Well, I know that he accused me of many things. What else? Go ahead. No, but let me finish. I already said it. So if he says, if there's an increased demand, and he explains that the fractional reserve banking system responds to an increased demand for bank liabilities with credit suspension, supply
of fractional reserve free banking that they're discussing.
Yeah. So, in this system, if there someone counterfeits money and puts it into a bank, it is an increase in the demand for bank liabilities, and the result will be more loans.
Can solve the problem if someone counterfeits money.
Eric, you're the questioner. He's
not
finished. He's trying to answer.
Oh, I am finished.
He's fast.
Well, the point is that it's not just that any amount of new money will actually represent real savings. The point is that the system they've described has a mechanism whereby the increase in money corresponds to an increase in real savings. That's the whole discussion of the theory of free banking, is that this system will work in this way, not that necessarily an increase in money is an increase in real savings.
Yeah, but they say an increase in demand for money should be responded to by creation of new money titles, and this is not sustainable. That's all what I say. If you then finance a real investment project with it, this is not sustainable. And there's many ways you can increase the nominal demand for bank liabilities. One is this here. I also say this is no increase in real savings. And another one is like just counterfeiting. Another one is just putting your gold under your mattress in the bank. There's no. You are saying this is all increase in real savings. Okay, I disagree.
With that, thank you.